We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. And our guest for the show is Daniel Hamilton. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. We'll try to talk about a number of things. The court just fairly recently has begun a new term, and we'll talk perhaps about some of the cases that will be discussed and some of the issues involved. And they involve things like gun rights and campaign finance and separation of church and state. One of the other things that a lot of people are interested in and looking at is how it is that the change in the makeup of the court, we have one new justice, how that perhaps will or won't change the way the court operates and the kind of decisions that they will hand down. We'll also talk a little bit about something that for a number of years now has been a subject of conversation, at least, and that is the workload of the court, meaning how many cases the court chooses to hear. So we'll try to touch on those things and as we talk, questions, comments from listeners are certainly welcome. We just ask people, first of all, be brief, stay on topic. That'll help us to get in as many different callers as possible and keep moving along. Questions certainly, though, are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, one of the things that I just came across that I thought was kind of interesting, I'm not exactly sure what it means, but apparently the Gallup organization recently did a survey and just asked people what their opinion was of the Supreme Court. And among the things that they found was that 61% of Americans approved of the court and the job that it was doing. 28% said they disapprove. And that apparently is the most positive rating the court has had in the last decade. Mm. Also, there has been a slight increase from 43% to 50% in the percentage of Americans who say they think the court is about right ideologically. And that apparently represents an all-time high. And there are some other things. I mean, people are really interested in this. They could go to the Gallup website and they can look at that. Mm-hmm. But I was struck by that. And I guess one thing particularly was that before the recent addition of Sonia Sotomayor, the makeup of the court had been the same for 11 years. And we really don't know how the court might change now that we have a new justice, which makes me wonder if you ask people, what do you think about the Supreme Court? What are they basing that on? Mm-hmm. You know, for most people, what they actually know about the court and how they think about it.
Well, it's interesting. Alexander Hamilton once famously said that the Supreme Court controls neither sword nor purse. And what he meant is that they have no control over either money, like the Congress, or the army, like the president. So its only tool at its disposal is a sense of legitimacy, is a sense that its word is authoritative. And that is something they guard quite closely. Hmm. And there have been times in history, of course, when they have lost that legitimacy, and they are very careful these days about holding on to it. That might, in fact, be one reason for what you described earlier, which is the dwindling Supreme Court caseload, which is to say that might be one way in which the court is holding on to its capital, keeping its powder dry, except on issues where it feels there really is unnecessary legal intervention.
Yeah. Another thing that really struck me is in just trying to look down the list of the cases that the court said that they will hear. Mm-hmm. There are a few things that stand out, because you know that those cases, they're going to get a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, rightly so, because they involve important issues. But there are a lot of other cases that the court's going to be hearing that there will be arguments, there will be decisions that probably will, unless you go to the legal press, will not get any coverage at all.
That's right. I mean, the vast majority of the cases will draw will get a great deal of attention from lawyers, believe me, but not from the public at large. We can predict now what the hot button issues will be for the public, and I should say those are the issues that in many ways involve the most important legal issues, which is to say they're hot button issues for a reason, because they go to the heart of some of the unsettled constitutional questions we have before us.
And that's the Second Amendment and church and state and campaign finance and the things that that no doubt we will also talk
abortion,
about
affirmative action, all these great political, legal, constitutional questions that so divide this court in particular. This court is quite polarized on those hot button issues. And there is a 5-4 lineup that is emerging in most of them. I should say there's a 4-4 lineup, which is to say
– with four clearly pretty conservative, four clearly pretty liberal, and then one guy, just Justice Kennedy, who is the one who generally is considered to be conservative but has voted with the liberals. So now he's our swing voter. He's the guy who could go either way.
Yes. William Brennan, the great justice, Supreme Court justice, famously said that the Constitution means whatever five Supreme Court justices say it means. And I think it's a bit of an oversimplification to say, but now the Constitution means what Anthony Kennedy says it means, which is to say – there is, as you point out, a fairly predictable 4-4 split on most of the hot button issues between what we could loosely call a liberal wing of the court and a conservative wing of the court. And it's not stable across all areas, but on many big issues it is. And Anthony Kennedy now is the swing vote who really decides those cases. And he votes with a majority well over 90% of the time in those hot button 5-4 issues, which is a new change, which is a really dramatic change for this court. It used to be both Justice O'Connor and Kennedy would swing. Now there is one swing vote on the most controversial issues, and both sides really do all they can to court his vote.
Well, we have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Now, my question that I'd like to hear you comment on is lack of a term limit for justices. I can understand maybe why you couldn't have a limit, but then by the same token, there's no accountability either. Why not just have them go like 12 years or some arbitrary number, 15, and that's it? And then they have to be replaced rather than put them on for life where they might be there 30, 40 years and be out of touch with reality. And I'd like to listen to your comments. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you.
No, that's an excellent question. And that has been something that has been drawn some more and more scholarly attention in recent years, which is to say William O. Douglas holds the record for having served on the Supreme Court for 36 years. There are at least two justices on this current court who might well break that record, the Chief Justice John Roberts and Clarence Thomas. And what are the costs of having judges on the bench on the Supreme Court for 30 or 40 years? Franklin Delano Roosevelt famously tried to impose an age limit on the bench, and it failed spectacularly when he tried to, quote unquote, pack the court. And it might be, and Paul Carrington, I was just talking before the show, at Duke Law School has put forward a fairly serious proposal to put on not an age limit, but a term limit, as the caller suggests, maybe 18 years, let's say. Simply to make sure the court remains more in touch with more of the country and does not get stuck inside its own bubble.
That's something we talked about that with him on this show some time back. And I suppose if people want to go hear that interview, it's in the archives. And I think that he has some interesting ideas and there are good arguments for it. One of the big difficulties will be, I think, as people recall, the Constitution says essentially that as long as the justices behave themselves, it's sort of it's stated in a kind of a vague way, but essentially as long as they behave themselves, they serve for life. So here either you would have to amend the Constitution, which is intentionally difficult, or you have to find some way to persuade justices to, in a sense, to voluntarily step down after a particular – institute a kind of a system that says after a certain period of time, what you're going to do is semi-retire. You might still be available to do some work, but that way there would be a constant and predictable turnover in the court.
And a third route which FDR sought, was to enlarge the size of the court, which is to say, once a justice hit 70 under his plan, he would simply add another justice until you reach some maximum level, because there's nothing in the Constitution that limits the size of the court. And we arrived at our current number of justices at 9 in 1869. But before then, there was there were more frequent changes of the number of justices on the court. And we could return to that, although politically, of course, that would be explosive.
I don't want to claim to be an expert on court history and spend a lot of time talking about court history, but I do think that it's kind of interesting in as much as we in our civics classes, you know, you'll remember the fact that we were taught, well, there are these three equal branches of government that intend that each have their distinct powers and intended to offset one another. Mm-hmm. But it seems that clearly if you go back and you look at what the framers intended, they really didn't think that these were three co-equal branches. They thought the Congress was most important, that probably the executive was second, and that truly the judicial was third.
Yeah, one of the great historical questions is, where did judicial review come from? In other words, where did the power to throw out a law of Congress by the Supreme Court come from? And historically, that's unclear, which is to say it's usually attributed to Marbury versus Madison. But there's a lot of recent work that says the court didn't really assert that as its sole power until much later. But I think historically, you're quite correct. And to large part, if we are talking history, which I'd love to do, but then I would give John Marshall the credit for really creating the powerful Supreme Court model that we have today.
Well, coming back to where we are now, anytime that one justice resigns and we have a new justice, one of the questions people ask, well, how is that going to change the court? And how is it likely to change the decisions they might make? So now we have a new justice, and people, of course, ask that question. And I think some people say, well, if you look at where the two justices are on the political spectrum, that is Justice now Sotomayor, where she is and the person that she replaced, you have to say that probably it shouldn't really change things at all.
That's right. That's right. She will probably, at least on the big hot button issues, the 5-4 issues, vote much as her predecessor did, David Souter. So we have these two wings, which we can loosely call the liberal wing and conservative wing. And the voting alignment won't change until someone leaves from the other wing, which is to say, if President Obama gets to appoint someone from the conservative wing, if a conservative justice leaves, then you will see a shift in this 5-4 breakdown. But now, even if we think that Justice Stevens might be the next one to retire, even if he retires, it looks as though whoever Obama replaces him with, if he does retire, might not change the voting alignment either. Now, having said that, it's very important to note that the court is a human institution that works very closely together over a number of years, and we cannot predict how the addition of any new person will affect that lineup.
That's. I was interested in reading some of the comments of members of the court talking about the fact that before Justice Souter decided that he would resign and was replaced by Justice Sotomayor, that the makeup of the court had not changed in 11 years.
Yes. That's one of the longest blocks in U.S. history, by the way.
And I was really struck by the fact that a number of the justices, including the Chief Justice, said that just having one new person coming in, they said they found that very unsettling, which to me seemed a little odd. Like, well, you know, it's only one new person.
Right.
But he, Justice Thomas, somebody else. There were at least three different people I read comments saying that they felt that the whole thing was just really, you know, sort of difficult.
It is a human institution, and the Supreme Court is a very small human institution, which is to say they're the justices and their clerks and some personnel, and they work together again and again over a number of years. And when the justices meet to vote on cases, there are nine people sitting around a table and no one else is in the room, which is to say when they have their conferences, it's one of the most secret places left in Washington, and we know very little about what goes on in there. But there are human interactions that are based on personality that change very much with the changing in personnel. If it changes to the lineup in votes is another question, and we don't predict that it will, but it might. It might. We cannot. She might be a very persuasive advocate for her views who might be able to persuade judges. This was, of course, Earl Warren, came onto the bench and turned a divided Supreme Court into a 9-0 unanimous opinion in favor of Brown versus Board of Education. So you can have one person coming on and really making a big shift in the voting pattern of the court. We'll see if it happens here.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Daniel Hamilton. He's professor of law and history here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the Supreme Court, the change in the court. Now we have one new member, and we'll talk about maybe a few of the cases the court will be hearing. We have a couple of callers here. We'd like to bring them in to the conversation. That's welcome. Again, we just hope people can be brief. That'll help us move along. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. These are both Champaign callers. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting with line one. Hello.
Hello, Professor. My question is I just got through watching pretty closely the Sotomayor confirmation and listening to all the conservative critics.
Mm-hmm.
And it galls me to no end to hear the conservatives talk about, will a liberal justice be... a judicial activist.
Mm-hmm.
As I think about the Hillary Clinton case and how it has been broadened to deal with the, in a broader way with a special hearing, and I look at how the Supreme Court, in my opinion, has reversed congressional enactments almost in an unprecedented way since maybe the New Deal, I view the conservatives on this court, including Kennedy, who seems to vote with them on these matters, as the epitome of judicial activism.
Mm-hmm.
What is your view on that?
Well, I think you make an excellent point, which is to say for decades, the left-right split on the court and commentary about the court was that there were liberal judicial activists who were overturning federal and state law in pursuit of their vision of the Constitution. And that charge was normally one made from the right against the left. In recent decades, as you point out, now that the court has essentially turned much further right, certainly than the Warren Court era, this court and the Rehnquist Court before this court was quite active in overturning federal law, particularly when it came to the interpretation of the Commerce Clause or when it came to state power versus federal power. So the charge of judicial activism, I think you're quite right, has become much more complicated now that essentially both sides are activist, which is to say both sides are quite willing to throw out acts of Congress and perhaps upset what is more or less settled precedent. It looks as though both sides are quite willing now to overturn settled precedent, and that is also new, and that's a change.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. I think that this just it underscores the perhaps the difficulty in this whole conversation about judicial activism because, well, it depends on what you mean by that.
Yes.
And if, for example, as the caller suggests, if you define activism by the willingness to overturn an act of Congress,
mm-hmm.
well, then this particular court, which is full of people who rail against activism, is probably one of the most activist court. Yeah. If that's what you choose as your measure of activism.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. How do you define activism? Is it your attention to precedent? Is it your attention to is it your deference to Congress, or is it the way you interpret the Constitution? Do you call the Constitution a living document that changes with the times, or do you say, no, it has a more or less settled, fixed meaning, and the job of the judge is to uncover that meaning?
Mm-hmm.
So those are really the three different ways you might define activism.
Is among historians, legal scholars, people like that, is there – is opinion on that question of – fixed, changing mm-hmm. with the time, that idea about the Constitution. Is there any sort of consensus? Is it pretty much, well, about half of them say one thing and half of them say the other?
I would say it is a new version of an old fight going on right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say the originalists were in retreat in the scholarly community, which is to say it had been on the wane. It has had a resurgence lately as the definition of originalism. Originalism takes as its premise we can uncover some sort of objective fixed meaning of the Constitution, either based on the meaning of the words or based on the intent of the founders who wrote the document. Mm-hmm. And a large part of the scholarly community thinks that's either impossible or undesirable, even if it were possible, that it ought to change with the times. So I would say it is a newly vigorous fight, and there are certainly very prominent originalists who are quite active in the scholarly community, arguing either for original meaning or for the original understanding of the Constitution. And there's one very powerful justice, namely Antonin Scalia,
yes,
who is an originalist on the bench,
yeah,
on the Supreme Court. And he's been quite effective in making his colleagues at least take the argument very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Another call here, line two. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have to state how pleased I was to see David Souter, not because of his beliefs or rulings, but because it seemed to me that justices have difficulty sometimes paying attention to good common sense.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked hard. I've come here. I've given a great deal. Now I think I'll just go home.
Mm-hmm.
That mindset seems to me quite extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you would speak about justices, and I know that some have actually taken a stance that was quite unpredictable from the viewpoint of those who were watching.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know if there's a couple of judges that come to mind specifically, and also, do the justices reflect the same kind of rancor and acrimony toward one another that, and I presume they don't, you know, in individual settings, but do they reflect the kind of acrimony that I notice in our nation today? I'm just going to hang up and listen to you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a fascinating question. So this is the two biggest examples of judges shifting unexpectedly while on the bench in the modern era might be David Souter, who retired, and Earl Warren, which is to say they voted in ways other than the president who nominated them thought they would vote. So when this is always frustrating to the president who appoints a Supreme Court justice thinking they will vote one way and then finding out that they vote another. So when President Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren, he thought he would be a more or less reliable vote for the more conservative agenda. But Warren, of course, went in completely the other direction, and Eisenhower ended up calling it the worst mistake of his life to have appointed Earl Warren as Chief Justice. So the presidents now are quite invested in trying to ensure that the candidate will vote the way they think they will vote. So with Souter in particular, they tried to do that by appointing someone who had almost no paper trail, someone who looked to be a blank slate, and it went the other direction. So now a great deal of thought goes into trying to ensure that the justice won't swing the other way. So, and it has been true to form, which is to say the most recent judges have voted the way the presidents would have liked them to vote. It is a human institution, though, and people do change on the bench. And we'll see if anyone does change on the bench. It doesn't look as though Roberts or Alito or Sotomayor will switch, but we can't be sure. The question of acrimony is interesting. They're very, very acrimonious in their decisions, which is to say, if you read the dissents that sometimes come out with the opinions of the Supreme Court, it is shocking what they will say to each other in print.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, in many ways, refreshing, which is to say the disagreement is transparent and it's open and it admits to the possibility that there's more than one answer and they have that debate openly. So maintaining cordiality on the court is something they work very hard to do. They traditionally, when they meet in conference, shake hands. Every justice shakes hands with every other justice. There are reportedly great friendships made on the court that sometimes cut across these ideological lines in very, very interesting ways. So it actually is a fairly cordial body, we think, even though you wouldn't know it based on their opinions, which can be really unbelievably nasty sometimes.
Yeah. Something else, and this isn't exactly the question that the caller was asking, but it is the relationship between, you know, is there, should there be some kind of relationship between the court and how they think and how they make their decisions and what the rest of the country thinks.
Right.
And there is this, we seem to have this idea that somehow they make their decisions in a bubble.
Right.
They listen to each other. They listen to the arguments. They think about past rulings. They think about precedent. But that somehow they're supposed to be resistant to public opinion as if they're apart from the rest of the country, which surely they cannot be.
Right.
And maybe you wouldn't want them to be.
Right. This is a subject of great scholarly debate, which is to say, should the Supreme Court essentially follow the election returns? In other words, make sure it is staying more or less in sync with the dominant political center or mainstream of the country. And some professors say absolutely not, which is to say they ought not to be concerned about public opinion at all. That violates what it means to be a judge. Whereas other people, other scholars, I should say, including myself, think, no, the court must guard its legitimacy very carefully and must make sure that it is in sync with what is politically feasible and what is politically desirable, which is to say, if you look at a case like Dred Scott, the infamous 19th century case that really helped perpetuate a civil war, you see the court getting wildly out of sync with popular sentiment, and that, of course, put the Supreme Court into a kind of under a cloud for decades. Having said that, there are times when the Supreme Court gets out ahead of public opinion and chooses to lead. The most famous example is Brown v. Board of Education, mm-hmm. where the court, knowing the country is going one way, chooses to take a leading role in trying to produce social change under the Constitution. Now, to be sure, many people would say and did say at the time, that's not what judges should be doing, but that's not what it means to be a judge would be the claim. But the counterclaim is there are times when it is important for the court to assert that it can interpret the Constitution in a way that expands its notions of liberties and protections and that it can risk its capital from time to time like it did in Brown.
Yeah. Certainly, I'm sure people would say that if you look at the cases that the court chooses to take, that will tell you something about the court.
Yes.
At the same time, I expect one would also say you can also look at the cases they choose not to take,
yes.
that they pass up, and
yes.
that will also tell you something about the fact that it seems that there are certain kinds of issues that at least at that point mm-hmm. the court is saying we just don't want to go there.
Right. And to some extent that's because it is settled, which is to say what is the role of precedent? So abortion might be the most important example in the mm-hmm. modern era, which is to say when Roberts was being confirmed and they asked him about Roe v. Wade, the answer is always now, I won't comment on sitting cases, but they give hints. They say, but I will not upset settled precedent, which might be a kind of code for I'm going to leave certain issues alone. And it might be that abortion is an example of an issue they've more or less decided to leave the fundamental legal question alone because they simply don't wish to reenter that legal and political fray, but they do surprise you from time to time, which is to say they will take on affirmative action or they will take on the Second Amendment or they will take on mm-hmm. Very political issues. So that it's not that they shy away from all of them, but they do shy away from some that either look settled or that look simply too disruptive to the majority understanding of the law.
Yeah. Our guest, again, in this hour of Focus 580 is Daniel Hamilton. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, and we're about midway through this part of the show. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I thought it would be interesting maybe just to talk a little bit about some of the cases mm-hmm. that the court will be hearing, those things that when you legal scholars, journalists, anybody mm-hmm. looks down at the list, jump off the page and say, well, this is obviously one that mm-hmm. is going to get a lot of attention. Are there particular things that you think are really interesting that will be up for discussion?
Yes. I think the Second Amendment case will be very important and will be very closely watched.
And certainly here in Illinois because it involves the city of gun ban in the city of Chicago.
Yes. Right? For the last 27 years, Chicago has banned gun sales within the city limits of Chicago. And in a recent – just last term, the Supreme Court really for the first time interpreted the Second Amendment to mean that it protects an individual right to bear arms, at least for the purposes of self-defense within the home. That is a case – DC, the Heller case, which was a ruling on a law in the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia is a federal territory, so we don't know if that ruling interpreting the Second Amendment applies only to federal territories, of which there are very few, or applies to state, local, and city government. And this Chicago case will test that legal principle, whether or not this landmark ruling by the Supreme Court does in fact apply to all cities, states, and local governments. If it does, then it might mean that huge numbers of local gun control laws are unconstitutional. In particular, it might be that the Chicago gun law is unconstitutional. Chicago is vehemently and vigorously arguing its position. That ruling, the Heller ruling, only applies to the federal government. And that question will be settled, and it could have a really huge impact on gun control laws in this country.
Hmm. It strikes me as curious, and maybe that's just the way the law is, that there would be this sort of small detail that in the first pass through on this issue, that they would have what would seem to be a very important and sweeping decision about the Second Amendment,
right,
and that yet one would fix on this tiny detail and says, well, now, wait a minute. No, we're really not talking about the entire country.
Right.
We're only talking about this tiny piece, and that if we're – then we have to ask the deliberate question, does this in fact apply to the entire country? And we're going to have to go through the whole – in a sense,
right,
go through the whole thing all over again.
Right. The question is, why didn't they address it the first time around?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the answer is twofold. Right. One, the answer on the Supreme Court is always they didn't have 5 votes for that proposition. Right. In other words, they were willing to go so far but no further. Mm-hmm. The second question historically is interesting, which is the Bill of Rights historically did not apply to the states. That's something most people don't really know, which is to say the Bill of Rights only restricted the federal government. So the First Amendment didn't apply in the states or any other Bill of Rights until well into the 20th century, when one by one the federal government, the federal courts started to incorporate different bills of rights, different parts of the Bill of Rights. Now, what they've never incorporated is the Second Amendment. Historically, this gets political, which is to say conservative justices have tended to oppose incorporation on the grounds that it gives too much federal power to the courts, gives too much power to the federal courts. And this will divide the court. This technical legal question of incorporation, should we incorporate the Second Amendment, will actually have a very sweeping effect on whether or not gun control laws are constitutional or not. And you can imagine really no – that is one of the hot-button issues of our time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the court has weighed in and will weigh in again in successive terms.
Questions are certainly welcome. Again, I just want to mention that if you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and it's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Daniel Hamilton. He's professor of law and history here at the University of Illinois. Tell us about another case that you think is particularly interesting.
I think that the question of campaign finances and free speech is going to come back in this court in a big way. It already has. There's a case called Citizens United, which turns on the creation of a movie made by a corporation that was strongly critical of Hillary Clinton and her candidacy for president. And the question there is, does campaign finance law – is that part of the campaign finance law restricting corporate speech unconstitutional? That's an interesting question that the court already has heard argument on. Another big question before this court, really to me, which is probably the most interesting question other than the Second Amendment, is what are they going to do about Guantanamo Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say, there is now – the Supreme Court decided last term that there is a right – the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay have a right to petition the federal courts for a writ of habeas corpus, which means they have a right to be heard in federal court to challenge the legality of their detention. So the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay have access to the federal courts. The question now is, once they're in the courts, what can the courts do with these prisoners? So there is a group of people in Guantanamo who are, the United States government admits, not a threat to the United States. They're a Chinese Muslim minority called Uyghurs, and they have gotten into federal court, and a judge in the federal courts has said, there's no basis to hold them. We have to let them go. And the circuit court has reversed that ruling and said, no, that's the president's decision whether or not to let them go. So the question is, what's going to happen? And will the Supreme Court essentially allow the federal courts to order the release of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, or will it say, no, that remains the president's decision? President Obama, of course, has put himself in a tough political spot in that when he became president, he said, a year from now, I will close Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. So we've got also, I should say, with these plaintiffs, with these 13 Uyghur plaintiffs, the administration is trying desperately to place them in other countries right now that will take them before the case comes to the Supreme Court. So what they've done is gone around the world and said, will you take these people? They're 13 plaintiffs. They've placed 4 of them in Bermuda. they've placed some number in the island, a nation of Palau, right? And so the administration is this race against time to try and make the case moot by making sure none of the plaintiffs are still in Guantanamo Bay. Now, the legal scholars, of course, would like to have this great constitutional question litigated, but this is something the Obama administration does not want to touch at all.
It seems to me that's just another really interesting chapter in this real back and forth involving Guantanamo and the people there between now two administrations,
yes,
and the court, and possibly involving the Congress here,
yes,
and there.
Yes. This is something where Obama took a decisive early stand. I'm going to close Guantanamo Bay within 1 year. And it has proven much more difficult to do than he imagined, both politically and constitutionally. The question politically is, what do we do with the people who are there? Can we find another country that will accept them? And legally, the question is, what are their rights under the Constitution? And the president essentially doesn't want to be boxed in. This is something that President Obama might share with President Bush, which is to say, the desire for maximum legal flexibility in dealing with Guantanamo. So that bears close scrutiny. We don't know what the Constitution demands with these prisoners. Do they have a right of access to federal courts? If so, can they be released? And once we decide to close Guantanamo Bay, what do we do with the people there if we can't find a foreign country that will accept them? Should they be tried in military tribunals? Should they be tried in civilian courts? Could they be held indefinitely by the president? We don't know the answers to these questions, and the Supreme Court has decided to weigh in and will continue to weigh in. This is really the one of the great unsettled legal questions being produced by the aftermath of 9/11.
Mm-hmm. We're coming into about our last 10-12 minutes here in this part of Focus 580, talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, a little bit about its makeup, how it works, some of the cases the court will hear in this current term, the 2009-10 session, where we have a new member, Justice Sotomayor. And questions here, welcome again. Our guest is Dan Hamilton. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also have another case that I'm sure is to get attention, that it's a church-state, mm-hmm, case that has to do with a display of a religious symbol on government property. What's that a case about?
There is a 8-foot-tall crucifix that stands on something called Sunrise Rock in the Mojave National Preserve, and it stood there since 1934. And the question is, does this cross on federal land violate the First Amendment's prohibition of the establishment of state religion, of the mixing of church and state? And what the Congress did to try and prevent this case from ever reaching the Supreme Court is it took the land upon which the crucifix was located and transferred it to a private group, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, in an attempt to keep it out of the courts. So you can see in this case and in the previous case about detainees at Guantanamo just how creative different parties can be in trying to make sure the Supreme Court doesn't rule on some of the most contentious issues. We'll see what the court does with this case, which is to say, if you talk about areas that the court is reluctant to get into, the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment has proven notoriously tricky, trying to set up a balance of what can the government do, what can't it do, school prayer, the Ten Commandments. These are very volatile issues that require very careful line drawing that is very tough to maintain. So the court has historically shied away from these cases. And if I had to predict, I predict it will shy away from a big ruling in this case as well. It will look for a narrow technical way to avoid reaching the merits. That's what, by the way, is so interesting about the gun case, is that it looks as though there's no way to decide it on narrow grounds. It looks as though the court will have to, as we say, reach the merits of what is constitutional and what is not constitutional. And that will, I'm sure, however the court comes down on the gun control case, become a big political issue for the upcoming congressional elections and then the presidential elections in the meantime. I don't know, for instance, speaking of the gun case, mm-hmm, what the gun laws are in Champaign-Urbana. Right. I don't know if there is a local gun control law that would now be declared unconstitutional, as thousands might be if the court comes down and upholds Heller as applying against the states.
Mm-hmm. Right. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question for the guest.
Mm-hmm.
How will history, if Clarence Thomas were to leave the bench today, what would history say, how to describe his tenure on the court?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, first off, it should be noted that Clarence Thomas's tenure on the court is in many ways just begun, which is to say he's relatively young. He's 61 years old. He will probably be on the bench. I mean, Justice Stevens is now 89 years old, which is to say he might have another 25-plus years left on the bench.
That Justice Thomas might.
Justice Thomas,
yeah, right.
Yeah. So a lot of it remains to be written. He was clearly bruised and quite affected by the battle over his confirmation, and that has led him to be a very private justice, even by the standards of Supreme Court justices. And he barely asks questions from the bench, and he doesn't write as many opinions as several of the other justices, but he is apparently quite well-liked by the other justices and quite well-liked by his clerks. We always care what the clerks think of their former bosses as they go out into the world. So I think I would say it has yet to be written. Much of it depends on how the rest of the court goes. If President Obama makes 2, 3, 4, 5 appointments to the court, then he might take on the role of lone dissenter for a number of decades going forward.
All right, thank you. I was interested to read just some comments from Mr. Thomas recently saying that he felt that his colleagues on the bench should keep their mouth shut more of the time in the sense that mm-hmm. and if people have heard, you know, the few opportunities we have now to hear
yes.
what the arguments, how they go.
Yes.
You know, the attorney is there in front of the court and he or she is trying to make their argument saying that I think this and I think this.
Yes.
From the bench, the justices are peppering this person with questions and they may well interrupt them.
They're constantly. You
know, constantly. They're trying to make a point and the justice says, well, what about this? And what about this? And do you mean this? And do you mean this? And it could be one justice and then another justice will come in and say, well, yeah, and what about this? And Mr. Thomas said, you know, well, maybe the justices should give the attorneys the opportunity to make their arguments and not interrupt
right.
so much. And it's pointed out, as you did, that when he's there on the bench, when the arguments are being made, apparently he says very little. Now, I don't know that necessarily is good or bad or says that he's a good justice or a bad justice, but I suppose that's one of those things that people will grab onto if they want to say something about his judicial temperament.
And, yes.
You know, whether he's, you know, how, as the caller says, how you answer that question, well, someday when we are talking about, you know, past justices, what are we going to have to say about
right.
it?
Right. I mean, oral argument is what you talk about is oral argument.
Right.
For anyone who hasn't been to the Supreme Court and seen oral argument, you definitely should because it's worth checking out. You can't watch it on television because the Supreme Court has been resolute about not allowing itself to be televised. Mm-hmm. I personally think it might serve democracy to have it televised. They do now have oral argument available online very quickly after the oral argument takes place, so you can easily find it on the web. The question with oral argument is always, who are they talking to? And the answer seems to be they're not talking to the person they're asking the question of. They're talking to each other. They are signaling to each other, look, this is how I'm thinking about this case. How will you answer this legal argument? And the poor lawyer in front of them, I shouldn't say poor lawyer, it's a huge honor to argue in front of the Supreme Court, is feeling like a ping pong ball being batted around by these very brilliant judges who are putting them through the ringer. It's definitely something worth watching.
And that, and you truly can then by following that and looking at what the justices say, the questions that they're asking, you truly can get some sort of hint about how they're going to think about that case and then how they might be likely to
right.
decide the
this,
case.
This is something where our batting average isn't very good as scholars and as political commentators, which is to say, we try desperately to read the tea leaves based on who asked what hostile question from the bench, and we don't have it doesn't have as much predictive effect as we would think.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear if oral argument has much consequence at all. In other words, the briefs are really what drives the outcome. But it is exciting, and it does tend to show you what at least they're thinking about, what issues are most on their minds. Yeah. And sometimes it gets quite heated. What is interesting, of course, is also when the judges are interrupting each other. And that's what they don't like, apparently. You can interrupt the lawyer to your heart's content.
Oh, yeah. Interrupting another justice.
Interrupting another justice.
It's bad. We have about 5-6 minutes left. There are a couple of other things I want to make sure that we talk
Please.
About. Just let's get back real quickly. We've talked a couple of times about Justice John Paul Stevens,
yes.
the fact that he's the oldest member of the court. He's
yes.
89 years old.
Yes.
And there apparently is already now some speculation that at the end of this term, that is the 2009-2010 term, he may well announce his resignation.
Yes. He has only chosen one clerk. People watch the judges and how they appoint clerks very closely, because mm-hmm. normally you can appoint four per term, and he has only appointed one. And the question is, what does that mean? What it might well mean is that he is signaling, I'm retiring, and you get one clerk in retirement. And the question then will be, who will replace him? And I guarantee you the White House has an internal battle going on right now about who that ought to be.
All right. We have a caller here in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Sorry I haven't been able to listen to the program, and apologize if this question has been asked. But is there a lot of argument among the judges over a case behind closed doors and in terms of deciding which way they are going to rule, what they are going to do, or do they sort of have the oral arguments that are done in public and then just send it off to somebody else, to one of the clerks, to write it up and talk about it? So can you fill me in quickly on that in case you've already talked about it?
Sure. No, we really haven't, mm-hmm. yeah.
That's a fascinating question. The clerks are very powerful, which is to say, coming out of law schools, there are a few people who are chosen to be clerks for Supreme Court justices, and they have a very powerful role both in synthesizing the huge number of cases that come into the court and helping them decide which cases to take, and then they will often write the first draft or part of a first draft of an opinion. And the clerks are very powerful, and they are, up till now, have been sworn to secrecy. In other words, they have never revealed their experience on the court. There are now more books being written by former clerks, and which is actually quite informative for legal scholars. Mm-hmm. What, to the extent that justices are trading ideas among themselves, we often don't know, which is to say, until years later when their papers are released. We know they vote in conference. They meet in private, and they vote. And then after they have a rough vote, whoever's in the majority, whoever is leading the majority, either the Chief Justice or the senior associate justice in the majority, will then assign the opinion to a judge. So they'll have a rough straw vote of how it's coming out. But it's only at that point that the real horse trading begins, which is to say, then they start sending around drafts from one office to another. And in past days, it's not clear this happens so much anymore. William Brennan was a master at this. They will roam the halls and they will say, listen, what's it going to take to get your vote on X decision? And there was some trading, clearly, that took place between the justices. It looks as though that's on the wane. Instead, they are sending memos back and forth on these legal issues. What does still happen is that justices change their mind based on the memos that are circulating. And yet, then you can have a whole new lineup. So it's very dramatic, actually, sometimes, particularly in these 5-4 opinions. They're all trying to court Justice Kennedy, as we come back to. And the question is, what issue is it going to take to get Kennedy, right? And so there's a huge amount of, I don't want to say politicking, but legal argumentation that goes back and forth.
You know, coming back to this, the power of the clerks, this is something that I was not aware of, and I'm very struck by. Thousands of cases come to the court, that is, people come to the court saying, will you hear this case?
Yes.
Thousands. And it is the clerks, actually,
yes.
who are sorting through all of those cases and picking out the ones that they think involve important questions or
that's
that the
right.
court should hear. They do some kind of summary.
Yes.
And then that goes to the justices, and then they choose among them which cases they would take. So the
that's
winnowing,
right.
the clerks are doing this. And I'm sort of thinking, well, that's a pretty important job to be entrusted to the clerks, because that could really make the difference between whether a case gets heard or not.
Yes. That is a hugely important role, and there are more and more cases that are brought before the Supreme Court asking for a hearing every year. It's now to about 10,000 cases a year,
yeah.
All of them are read by these clerks, every single one, including by pro se litigants litigating on behalf on their own behalf. And that is where the clerk's power is really, really at its peak in helping the justice decide which cases to take. Now, the justices do play a very close role in deciding ultimately which cases they do hear. And this is what we referred to earlier. The workload of the Supreme Court has been essentially cut in half since the 1980s. So during the 1980s, the Supreme Court decided about 150 cases a year. This year, it decides about half that many cases. And the question sort of is, what is producing this change? Mm-hmm. And it might be, as you suggest, that the clerks are taking more and more of a activist role in winnowing out the number of cases. But this is something that we debate. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, that the Supreme Court is hearing fewer cases?
Well, that is the question. I mean, is the fact that there has this been decline in the caseload, that's something people have been talking about, commenting on, some cases complaining about now for quite a few years. And the question is, well, so what? I mean, is that a bad thing, or is that neither good nor bad?
Right. The question is, are important legal issues being left undecided? And that depends on who you ask. What we do know is that it used to be that the court felt compelled to clear up disputes between the circuit courts. So the federal circuit courts have a dispute on a legal matter, a constitutional matter. The court felt compelled to settle that dispute. It does not feel that way any longer, and it will let stand these disputes. And if you ask me, that is about the court marshaling its power, keeping its powder dry for what it considers to be the most important legal issues of the day. Having said that, there are many people out there who think that is doing a real disservice, and it's leaving unsettled questions that ought to be settled by the Supreme Court.
Well, there we'll have to leave it for the moment. With our thanks to Dan Hamilton, he's professor of law and history here at University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Ultimately, which cases they do hear, and this is what we referred to earlier. The workload of the Supreme Court has been essentially cut in half since the 1980s. So during the 1980s, the Supreme Court decided about 150 cases a year. This year, it decides about half that many cases. And the question sort of is, what is producing this change? Mm-hmm. And it might be, as you suggest, that the clerks are taking more and more of an activist role in winnowing out the number of cases. But this is something that we debate. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, that the Supreme Court is hearing fewer cases?
Well, that is the question. I mean, is the fact that there has this been decline in the caseload, that's something people have been talking about, commenting on, some cases complaining about now for quite a few years. And the question is, well, so what? I mean, is that a bad thing, or is that neither good nor bad?
Right. The question is, are important legal issues being left undecided? And that depends on who you ask. What we do know is that it used to be that the court felt compelled to clear up disputes between the circuit courts. So the federal circuit courts have a dispute on a legal matter, a constitutional matter. The court felt compelled to settle that dispute. It does not feel that way any longer, and it will let stand these disputes. And if you ask me, that is about the court marshaling its power, keeping its powder dry for what it considers to be the most important legal issues of the day. Having said that, there are many people out there who think that is doing a real disservice, and it's leaving unsettled questions that ought to be settled by the Supreme Court.
Well, there we'll have to leave it for the moment. With our thanks to Dan Hamilton, he's professor of law and history here at University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you.